I'm Rose Aguilar. Welcome to a KALW special program for Indigenous Peoples Day. After more than 150 years, historians, and perhaps Californians, are facing up to the horrifying truth that the Indians of California were subjected to a campaign of extermination from the beginning of U.S. control in 1846 until after the Civil War. New scholarship shows that Indian slavery was the key source of labor that helped create the early economy of California and enrich its first settlers. As part of the Shaping SF Public Talk series, I moderated a panel about the legacy of Indian slavery and genocide with Lizbeth Haas, author of Saints and Citizens, Indigenous Histories of Colonial Missions and Mexican California, Elias Castillo, author of A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions, and Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutzen tribe. So I want to start off by asking all of you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be on this journey. Valentin, as the other native on the panel, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your tribe?
Thank you very much, Rose. And I want to give blessings and thanks to the Yamalu people. The Yamalu are the tribal folks who were here before first contact. My name again is Valentin Lopez, and I'm the chairman of the Amamutzen Tribal Band. And our tribe is comprised of the documented descendants of the indigenous peoples that were taken to Mission San Juan Bautista and Mission Santa Cruz. A lot of people refer to us as Ohlone, but we prefer our Amamutzen identity. The word Ohlone, there's no indigenous word Ohlone. The Ohlone comes from the word Ohon. At the tribe that was at Pescadero was the Ohon tribe, O-L-J-O-N. And the Spanish referred to them as Ohone. And pretty soon everybody from San Francisco to Monterey got identified as Ohlone. The central coast of California from San Francisco down to Monterey was the most populous area north of Mexico City in all of the Americas. And all, you know, and Canada, Alaska, north of Mexico City, this area was most populated. And it's easy to understand when you look at the water, the resources, the rivers, the food sources, the plants. It's a paradise, an absolute paradise. And our creation story tells us that Creator very specifically picked our people to live on these lands. And then Creator gave us a responsibility to take care of Mother Earth and all living things. And for thousands and thousands of years, our people did that. And we took care of and we managed and stewarded the lands. Then came the mission period. And the missions were just brutal, absolutely brutal on our people. It said at first contact, well, I said earlier, 30,000 indigenous people, many, many of them were taken to the missions. We have five missions in Ohlone territory. At the close of the missions, Alan Leventhal from San Jose State says that less than 100 of the Ohlone people who were taken to the missions survived to leave the missions. So you're going from 30,000 approximately to 100. You know, during mission times, you're having to go away as Fresno and Coarse Gold and into the mountains to recruit Indians to bring them to the missions. And the missions were just brutal. There's a lot to say about the mission time. That was followed by the Mexican period. The Mexican period was brutal as well because the Mexican folks who were well-connected got these huge land grants, but they needed a labor force to manage their lands because nobody else was here. And what they wanted to do was to raise these huge herds of cattle, horses, sheep, pigs, etc. And they needed a labor force, and the Indians were here. And the Indians worked under slave conditions mostly, and a few of them did get paid meager wages. But there were absolute brutal times as well. And then that was followed by the American period. And during the American period, there was absolute suicide. So during that period, I know you asked for a little bit of background. I gave a little bit more than I intended to. But these are the topics that I hope that we can talk about tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Lizbeth?
Two things occur to me. One, Val is telling a story that I moved I moved from Ohio with my family when I was young to the borderlands, to San Diego. And we weren't native, but we came in with a swell of Ohioans moving into San Diego. And I felt like we were moving to the borderlands. And when I, as I was growing up, I became interested in history and lived kind of San Diego, Mexico as a borderlands, as a kind of place that was a was a place from here, from the place we came to. And so, and I ended up writing my first three books on this history of first conquest and historical identities, and that's really a very local history, but about large processes of colonization and American annexation of California and what happened thereafter. People defending them, Indian people, Mexican people, the Anglo people who came, defending themselves based on their sense of their history and their sense of their rights. And there was a, that was on, again, Southern California. Then the next book was, and why did I want to write this? I mean, I was very interested in place, having left a place, having been uprooted a number of times in my life, that I think this place had become a fascinating place to me. So that was, I actually went back to the mission era, but the first book was on a kind of Chicano history and a transition into the American era. The second one was on precisely two of them, Native histories of California. And I, what I was interested in, especially in indigenous histories of colonial and Mexican California and saints and citizens, was in the production that indigenous people did in those missions. Even though, as Val said, they were such horrific places. And as a historian, when I started working on the missions, just wanting to tell a much better history than had been written about these missions, I found it difficult to be in those archives. I mean, that they were very haunted, very haunted. And being vulnerable to this haunting, I was absolutely fled at one point home from Santa Barbara, from one archive. And an anthropologist I was working with was disdainful. Beth, you know this history. You know everyone died. But I, so it could, it can haunt. But then what saved me there, what made me able to write a book, was simply that Native people lived that story, and a kind of their strength, their story in having lived it, their sources, their paintings, their writing, the way that they, their property ownership, their citizenship rights in the Mexican era. So it's not that I make this a pretty story, but I do say Indian people had a story there. They had a real history that they did leave records about. And so it's kind of adding to the story of horror something that's more maybe recuperable.
I'm Elias Castillo, and I'm the author of this book, which is the nation's first book that details with irrefutable evidence what the Indians suffered in the missions, and that Sarah was no saint, never a saint, that he ordered the whipping of Indians, and I found letters in which he said that. And I, in particular, found one letter which he says, writes to a superior in Mexico City and says, well, here at the missions, we're all having our little problems. But at mission, I forget what the mission was, I think it was San Gabriel. But at mission San Gabriel, we're having two wonderful harvests. One is of the grain that is filling our bushels, and the other is of the children who are dying of a plague. That tells what you need to know, that Sarah was a fanatic, an extreme fanatic. He didn't care about the Indians. He only cared about whether they lived, whether they died. And then in 1820, Father Mariano Payeras, the last Spanish presidente of the mission, the 21 missions, wrote a scathing letter to his superior in Mexico and said, all we are doing for the Indians is baptizing them, presenting the sacraments, and burying them. It says, we have wiped out all of the Indians outside of the missions. And in the missions, they live for only 2 years in horrible conditions. They we have to go out into the San Joaquin Valley, to other areas, and force them into the missions where they quickly die. The conditions here are horrible. It would be nice to have very nice places, but they're not. They're death camps. And we have done it because we did as we were told. Now, what got me to write about this? I had had inklings of just how bad it was. But I decided at one time to write a book and present the irrefutable evidence, not things that I thought had happened, but to find the proof, to the point that when Val read my book, he said, told me, I thought I knew how bad it was, but after reading your book, I know that it was 10 times worse than I thought. It took me 7 years of research in going to Mexico's National Archives, the Santa Barbara Mission Archives, Bancroft Library, Stanford Library, San Jose State Library, to find what I was looking for. And the Franciscans published letters written by the heads, directors of the 21 missions. And there's the writings of Junipero Serra, the writings of Lasuen, the writings of Mariano Palleras. Lasuen, there are streets named after him, there are numerous streets and statues throughout the state of Serra. But Serra was a maniac. That's the only word you can say. He's a maniac in his attitude towards the Indians. Better that they died than they'll go to heaven. And, well, what about their life on earth? That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that's what, not only him, but all the Franciscan friars had that attitude. So as I delved into this and began finding evidence, like I said, irrefutable evidence, because it was published by the Franciscans, by the Americans, by the Academy of American Franciscan History, in these books published by the Franciscans. That's where I found these damning letters. And I just grew angrier more as I found more of these. And I also found descriptions a French admiral named Peru, who was in charge of a French expedition on the Pacific Rim, visited Monterey. And he was horrified at what he saw. He says, what I see is nothing different than the slave plantations in the Caribbean. And then he made this statement. He says, women are never whipped in public, but are taken to a far and isolated place that their screams may not incite the men to riot. He says, the sound of the whip and the thud of clubs is common wherever they are marched. Conditions here are horrible. I wish that the friars could be a little bit more enlightened. Now remember, this was in the 18th century. What was the 18th century? It was the century of light, the century of enlightenment, where the divine rights of kings was being destroyed, and the rights of all human beings was being held up. That was the most important thing. So it was an age of where the first governors of California were military commanders, and all of them despised the missions. There was no, the governor's saying these missions are just wonderful. They didn't. They had constant battles with the friars, which I began finding these letters written by the governors, the exchanges. And in one exchange with one of the governors, Sarah says, the governor asks, why are you treating the Indians so horribly? And Sarah's response was, when you have a civilization as savage as this, the only way to control them is by blows, as Father Solano did in Peru. It says, whenever the Indians disobeyed him, he whipped them. And that was his reasoning. And Lasuen, Sarah's successor, said, you've got these savage civilizations, and they're loathsome, and they're akin to animals. It's just, and one after another, you know, this is what the friars did. There were,
Elias says that about probably 90% of Californians really don't know anything about the missions. How many of you learned about the missions in school or?
The truth about the missions. The truth about the
okay,
missions.
Okay, the hands go down.
Yeah.
All the hands go down.
The State Board of Education of the state for decades ordered that all fourth graders were to be told about missions and how wonderful they were and how Sarah was just a saint and how he helped found California. He did nothing of the sort. It was the governors of California. In fact, the first cities established in California was, the first one was Los Angeles. No, the first, I'm sorry. First one was San Jose and then followed Los Angeles. And why were they established? The governors wanted to break the monopoly that the missions had. These monopolies, the missions were not just little simple churches. They and what about would 100 and maybe over 100,000 acres for each mission? Is that what you
yeah,
about 100,000. They were enormous. They were they all had the best lands, and they were enormous. They had cattle herds. Each of them, 21 of 35,000 approximately.
Can you talk more, Val, about the idea behind the missions, why they were created in the first place?
Well, a lot of folks think that the missions started with the Franciscans or the Jesuits when they were coming in. But the whole foundation of that conquest started with the papal bulls that were issued starting in 1454 by Alexander VI, and there was a couple other papal bulls after that by the popes that followed. But the papal bulls, they were starting to discover these new lands as they started going further and further out, more exploring and stuff. And they wanted to make sure that those new lands became a Catholic. Or under the direction of Portugal, for example, who was a Catholic nation, and Spain, which was a Catholic nation, and so the papal bulls declared that all indigenous people are the enemies of Christ, that they have no soul, that they are pagans, savages, and heathens. They're nothing more than that. That they are to be cast into perpetual slavery, and that their property and their possessions are to be taken from them. And there's other things as well. But shortly after the papal bulls were published by the popes, that is when slavery in Africa went. Portugal went down to Africa. And under the direction, the moral authority and moral direction of the popes, of these papal bulls, over 12 million Africans were captured and sold into slavery around the world. And then India, and then Indonesia, and the Pacific Islands, and then the Americas. So the papal bulls, so a lot of people think that the missions of California were established after, to follow the steps of Jesus Christ. But they were actually following the directive of the papal bulls that were issued by the popes of the Catholic Church. I was Catholic. I'm no longer Catholic, but I was Catholic, and I have friends who were bishops, and I'm still good friends with them. And they said that the Bible very clearly teaches how to proselytize. He says, if you look at the story of the Good Samaritan, that Jesus there is teaching how to proselytize. You proselytize with words, with deeds, with actions. That's how you proselytize. And then he said, if you look at St. Francis, and Junipero Serra was a Franciscan priest, and that was named after St. Francis, who was an evangelizer. And they said that he evangelized with words, deeds, and actions. The church, the missions that came to California were not following the directives of Jesus. We're not following the steps of Jesus Christ. They were very clearly following the directives of the papal bulls. And that's why today the church has all the lands where the missions went. And the California Indians, many of them are just landless Indians today, as are the Amamutsin.
You're listening to a special KALW program for Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm Rose Aguilar, and in this program, recorded as part of the Shaping SF Public Talk Series, I was joined by Lizbeth Haas, author of Saints and Citizens, Indigenous Histories of Colonial Missions and Mexican California, Elias Castillo, author of A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions, and Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutsin Tribe. And Lizbeth, you wrote an op-ed in the Chronicle about the Pope's decision to canonize Sarah. And at that point, that was last year, right? And a lot of articles came out, and a lot of people were talking about it and learning about it for the first time in many cases. Talk a little bit about why you think that happened, and do you think that the articles that came out criticizing the decision made any difference at all?
Well, the desire to canonize Sarah came from, there's always a desire among whatever order you have of missionaries to canonize some of their missionaries. So we have saints like Solano that you mentioned was from Peru. He's from Spain. He went to Peru. He became a saint. I believe he went to Japan very briefly and then went back to Peru. So he has, they all have their own histories, and there's a reason to make them into saints because they're part of this, really, what is a brutal conquest of other people. And so a lot of the saints, for example, of the Franciscans came from the Crusades of that era. Again, a brutal history. Many of the saints were virgin martyrs. They were telling the history to anyone who became a Christian in one form or another, brought into the mission, that in fact, there is your history now, your new history. You can be a virgin martyr. If your family doesn't want you to be Christian, be like Santa Barbara. Stick with your religion and not your family. Or be like Santa Inez. Stick with your new religion, not your family. So they brought in new orders of historical thinking, new ways that made sense to them. But let's see. So that's simply to say, what I wanted to emphasize is that in Latin America, you do have this deep, long history of expropriation of Native people's lands, and yet very different histories in each country. So I think we're the same is true for the U.S. Even though we ceased to be part of Latin America in the 1850s, this colonization fit that pattern, and we have a lot of Latin America within the structures of our early history. So, but the missions we know to say, just one that we know today, are a product of American thinking and believing. They reinforced in coming like we did from Ohio, but in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, they came out and said, oh, these are decaying structures. Their people are clearly from the past. Let's make these structures something for ourselves, our history. And so that is really a lot of what we know from the El Camino Real, which didn't exist like that, to all of the mission structures we know. They're fictive. I mean, if you read the 19th century literature, they're painted by Indian people who still lived around them because they're built on their land. Or it came to be their land because they became part of those missions. But without giving into a kind of Catholicism that came from the Spaniards, they had made lives there, and they would claim those lands at various points in history. Well, they often didn't get them, but sometimes, like Santa Inez, they got land near the mission. So they continued to paint those missions and use those missions because they appropriated them for themselves in the case of Indian people who remained Catholic. So I just want to emphasize that the missions, the Americans would go to those missions and they'd say, oh, these are painted in horrible colors, reds and greens and blacks. Oh, this has nothing to do with the real mission. So they pushed Indian people out of the missions, pushed, made them devoid of their histories, and made them into these money-making institutions that they are today. So it's not how they even looked, much less who they belonged to, who they were built by.
And Elias, talk a little bit about where the idea to teach this lie about the missions really came from. Where did it originate?
Well, it originated about in the 1880s. And what happened was Helen Hunter Jackson, an author who was very much disturbed by the slave trade in the United States, wanted to do the same thing for the California Indians. So during that period, 1880s, she wrote a book called Ramona about a Mexican woman married to an Indian and the discrimination they faced. And at one time, they were so stricken by so much discrimination, they had nowhere to go. They were always hounded. They went to a mission, which was not a mission anymore. It was just a parish church. But she describes it in these glowing colors. Which they did. They did take care of the gardens in the mission. They had fountains. They had little groves of trees. Nothing compared to the hundreds of thousands of acres that they had in the past, in which they were factories, building saddles, bridles, tools, whatever you needed to improve the economy. And they were able to sell them at whatever price they wanted to. Anyway, so Ramona came out, and including the description of that one parish church, which has been formerly a mission. And land developers looked at that and said, now we can use the missions as magnets to attract people to California. We will tell them this is the great land of the missions and the Indians, and in the missions they just lived with the friars and loved each other. It was idyllic, and we need to get people out here. And so they did. They launched a public relations campaign describing the missions formerly as one wonderful places, which they weren't. They were death camps. And by then, about three-quarters of the missions were just piles of adobe bricks and timber and so forth. Some of them were being used for stables. No one knew what they were for. Most of the people didn't know what they were for, what they had been used for, or the brutal history behind them. And so they looked at these, and then all of a sudden, the real estate developers, real estate types said, "My gosh, this is great. We've got now a description of the missions, what they were." And that's what they emphasized, the beauty of the missions and the wonderful kindness of the authors and how Sarah was just a wonderful guy and so forth. And that's how the legend, the myth of the missions was started, by land developers and real estate people trying to get people to come to California. And then it just kept building up, and State Board of Education fell for it. They didn't know the history. No one knew the history really at that time. You know, to most people and most officials, the mission ruins were just piles of junk. And then they went to the Big Four, which was Stanford, Crocker, Huntington, and who was the fourth? Hopkins, and told them, "Hey, you have got to help us, because you guys are already rich, but we can bring more people with this story." And so the Crocker, Compton, and Huntington, and Stanford said, "Great, we'll bring them up. We'll encourage. We will provide the money to rebuild the missions into what they were formerly." And of course, they didn't know anything about the history of this. Not until Bancroft wrote his definitive work, which is still definitive, History of California, did people begin to realize how horrible, the horrors and the nightmare that the missions were. And then, of course, the Catholic Church said, wonderful. This is wonderful. Now we can really say how wonderful Sarah was. And that's how the myth started. That's how the mission myth. You know, the Catholic Church never corrected anyone. Why should they? You know, somebody else, Helen Hunt Jackson, had done it for her. But Helen Hunt Jackson had written the story of Ramona like Uncle Tom's Cabin, because that's what she wanted to do, to just show her horse. But everybody, but because the real estate developers logged on into their description of the missions, that's what came on. Of course, they had lots of money, the real estate developers, to do this, to really build this up, story up. And they did. And a lot of people fell for it.
Did you get a reaction from the Catholic Church after your book was published?
No. Absolutely nothing. And they know damn well that it's irrefutable evidence. They published it. They published the letters. And they, thankfully, the Franciscans were good scholars, and they included all of the bad, venomous letters that Lasswin, who was Sarah's successor, said included, well, when you've got a civilization this savage here, you have to punish the Indians more. You have to inflict them punishment to enable to control them. They are akin to animals. And then another friar who did a history of their beliefs, Boscano, said, well, these Indians are akin to monkeys. That's how the friars looked at the Indians. And horrible. And of course, I have the letters that they wrote. I didn't make these letters up. And no one else did, other than they themselves. And like I said, I spent 7 years looking for these letters to publish them in this book, which I felt needed to be done in order to tell the real true story of this genocidal campaign that was launched by the Vatican Church under, as Val said, the doctrines which were basically ordered to give. Speaking of the doctrines, let me read to you one document that was called the requerimiento, the requirement. This was to be read to all conquered Indian nations in the New World in Spain. And they was to tell, it was read to them in Spanish. They didn't know Spanish. You know, they'd go before some king, Indian king, and ready to read it to them. They had no idea.
Val, you were talking about the reaction you had when you first read Elias's book. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I had a lot of the oral histories and oral stories we learned growing up. I mean, I remember my grandmother's talking about the brutality at the mission. There's a story that she told that whenever they were told, she said, whenever an Indians came in, they could not speak their language. And this one person insisted on keeping his tongue, and he would speak the Mutsin language. And after being warned and whipped a number of times, the priest ordered that the soldiers cut his tongue out. And so they cut his tongue out for speaking his language. And another one, he had ran away a number of times, and the bottoms of his, and so to address that, they sat him down like that with his feet out, and they beat the bottom of his feet with a club until they're breaking bones in there, so that he had to hobble or crawl wherever he went thereafter, so that he would never run away again. And there's one more story. I hope you don't mind me telling this one. But it's a story that we had told in our, within our tribe. This is a story that was passed down to us. And I told this story in public a number of times, and I believe I even told it on the radio station when I was on there last year. And there's a researcher, Randy Milliken. Somebody asked him about the story that I was telling him. And he says that he doesn't believe that's true, that we're probably just making it up. And so I'm here telling our story. And there's an anthropologist who's probably maybe one of the most scholarly anthropologists on mission history going behind there and saying that we're just that we're not telling, that we're making that up. Well, we found three references to that. There's in Los Banos, there's one of the researchers left his notes at the Los Banos, and it verifies this story that I'm going to tell. Also, one of our elders left 78,000 pages of notes at the Smithsonian, and that's in there, and it's at one other source, and I forget what the other source is. But here's the story. In the town of Newman on I-5, there was a tribe called the Orestimba tribe. And the way that we were, you know, and the way that, and we're talked about how they caught, captured that tribe. You know, they would send, you know, they would send out scouts to see what the villages are, and then they would send the troops out, and then other natives who went with them. And early morning, they would raid on horses into that village, and they would target the women. They always targeted the women for capture. They would capture the women and tie them together thumb by thumb to form a human chain. Once they captured all the women, then they would start marching them back to the mission. And this one here, they were going back to Mission San Juan Bautista. Now, they knew that by marching the women back, that the children would naturally follow the mothers. And that it was just a matter of time before the husbands and fathers came in to be with their families. And that's how the Indians were brought to the missions. This Orestimba tribe, once they crossed over the peaks of the mountains there, there was this little area that they called the Orestimba Narrows. And it's a real narrow area. The rocks shoot up about 400 feet, and there's a little narrow path that you can pass through there. Once they passed through the Orestimba Narrows, all the women and children just sat down and refused to go any further. And they were, the soldiers did everything they could, beat them, whip them, drag them, brutalize the babies, do everything they could to try and get them to go further. After a number of days, the commander said, "Kill them all and spread the remains." Over 200 women and children were slaughtered, killed, and their remains were spread. And then when they got back to the mission, the soldiers were sworn to secrecy by the priest that they would never tell that story. In about 1840 or thereabouts, I believe it was, one of the soldiers, he was carrying all that guilt with him all that time, and he told that story and he got it documented. Frank, the guy from the Yokotes, I can't think of his last name now. Anyway, that's in his book as well. So it is documented, you know, but yet we tell that story, and we have another anthropologist saying that our tribe is just making that up. But that, you know, but we have these stories within our tribe of the brutality. So whenever I saw Elias's book, I said, that's what we need, because people don't believe our stories. We tell our oral histories, and no one believes it. But now we have the documentation to prove the brutality and the horrors that happened at that mission.
What Val just said is absolutely true. That was my goal, is to, in fact, when I first showed him the book, he wanted to read it. And after that, we worked very closely when the book came out also. Yeah, and he wrote the foreword for the book, so it's a brilliant foreword, which really adds. But getting back to the requerimiento, it winds up with saying, well, now you must swear your allegiance to the king, or to the pope, the king, and to the nation. If you do not, then. If you do, and let me read, just the words alone are horrible. If you do not comply or maliciously delay obedience to my injunction, then with the help of God, I will enter your country by force, declare war on you with the utmost violence, subject you to the yoke of obedience to the church and king, seize your wives and children and make slaves of them, and sell or dispose of them according to His Majesty's pleasure. I will seize everything you own and do everything within my power to bring misery to you as rebellious subjects who refuse to acknowledge or submit to their lawful sovereign. I declare that all the resulting bloodshed and calamities shall be blamed on you and His Majesty, or the gentleman who shall serve under me. And then at that time he says, now will the notary with us sign the papers that this has been read to. So that gives you an idea of what happened to the Indians. This was by the time the Spanish got up to Alta California, they didn't bother reading this. Pardon?
I want to say one thing. Oh, yeah. Whenever they were in Mexico, over 23 million indigenous people died under the conquest. It's estimated 23 to 31 million people died during the conquest. And when I look at the papal bulls, I say the papal bulls are giving the moral and legal authority for that to happen. And you know, and then that's unimaginable that could happen. So, you know, so where's the morality in that?
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but those papal bulls have never been rejected.
No, they're official church doctrine today. Official church doctrine today, the papal bulls.
Yeah, they've never been rejected. They're still out there, and that's what the California Indians want, those papal bulls to be rejected and destroyed and burned, because that the church still believes that. They've never rejected them.
You're listening to a special KALW program for Indigenous Peoples Day. This conversation about the legacy of Indian slavery and genocide in California was part of the Shaping SF Public Talk series. Learn more at shapingsf.org. Lizbeth, as a professor of history at UC Davis, I'm sorry, UC Santa Cruz, in terms of curriculum, raising awareness, museums, I mean, what changes would you like to see? Because we don't have many museums. There's not much in the schools about this. And, you know, I'd love to hear your opinion as to why. We hear a lot about American exceptionalism. We talk a lot about the founders, the founding of this country. How can we get past that to bring this information to a wider audience so it's out there for us to see in daily life?
Right. Well, one way, at least, to begin perhaps with the missions themselves. There could be pressure put on those missions because they do have their own ownership, so to speak. The church is in charge of some, owns some, and the national parks own others. But in all cases, envisioning and insisting upon, one, the people who were in those missions, those descendants have a right to that property, to some kind of right to that property to be established, but they have to be there in the interpretive space. Their lands have to be recognized. For some missions, that means you're going to have to recognize lands in the Central Valley of Yokuts people. You're definitely going to have to recognize all the lands within the large circumference of the missions. So recognizing the absolute rights of land that had never actually been given legitimately over to the Spanish and then the Mexican state. That would be one thing that we just have to really insist upon, remap our own understanding, even of this city. I think that's one thing that you all are trying to do. And this is definitely, the missions have to be remapped so we understand all of the people's lands, specific lands, that those missions are on. I think then the people, the descendants of the missions, have a right to have some say in how the missions are represented. And in fact, some groups of people, probably in each mission, are asking for that, for demanding a say in even more than a say. Some would like the missions to be turned over to the tribes that built them. But short of that, they would like some ability to tell the whole story from their perspective and from what actually happened.
Val, what would you add to that? You actually wrote legislation that would have required the California government to not only apologize to Indians but also acknowledge the past. Can you talk about what happened with that?
Last year in October, I was meeting with an assembly member, and I was talking to him about the history of California Indians and about how they were paying bounty money and how there was an order of extermination by the state of California and how they had military expeditions going out to find the Indians to kill them. And then they had laws of indentured servitude and laws that legalized the kidnapping of children where they would kill the parents, take that child, and then go sell the child. And you know, and men and boys would sell for $150, and girls would sell for $300. That's kind of the going rate. And over 10,000 children were kidnapped under those conditions. Well, I say children, they weren't all children. Over 10,000 documented sales of kidnapped people were documented. But I was talking to the assembly member about that history, and then he says, has the state of California ever apologized? And says, no, the state of California has never apologized to the Indians. And then he said that he's going to write a bill, that he would sponsor a bill to apologize to the California Indians. And he said, I want it to be a bill and not a resolution, because the bill, the governor would have to sign it. So this apology would be coming from the governor's office. And so I said, this is great. I left there feeling really good. But then the more I thought about it, I said, man, all we're going to do is just get some little, we apologize wording that means nothing. They're not saying what they apologize for or what they did. I mean, they could be apologizing because we survived the extermination order, and that's what they're apologizing for, you know, not completing the job. I mean, so I started saying, if they're going to have a meaningful apology, they have to say what they're apologizing for. And so before I retired in my job, I drafted legislation and stuff. So I said, I'm going to draft the type of apology that I would want, that I want to see. And so I wrote an apology, and it was kind of lengthy, but it had a lot of specifics in there about the actions and apologizing for this action and this action and this action. And that was not uncommon. I mean, because I based the legislation that I wrote off of an apology that the state of California gave Mexico, gave to the Mexicans of the state for whenever they were sending them out of the country, even the legal citizens, they were sending them out of the country in the 1930s and such. And so I based it on that legislation. Anyway, I sent it into the assembly member, and I quickly got a response back that the assembly member would not be sponsoring legislation. Would not be sponsoring the legislation for the apology. You know, they just want to give some apology. And then when I was talking about this earlier, the whole issue of apologies, I mean, I'm tired of apologies. I mean, Pope Francis goes down to Ecuador, and he apologizes to the indigenous people for the sins, the crimes, and the offenses. You know, and as if though that is enough. Just giving an apology, we're supposed to accept the apology and say, okay, now everything's straight. You know, and then in the encyclical letter, he says, you know, that it's a sin to destroy people's culture, their environments, and the people. It's a sin. And so I'm thinking that I don't want an apology. I want a confession. I want the Catholic Church and all perpetrators, Spain, Mexico, the government of California, the government of the United States, to confess their sins, their crimes, and their offenses, and to very specifically say what they did, why they did it, how many times they did it. And then for them to have a penance. What penance are they going to serve because of their offenses? And then atonement. What are they going to do to correct that? You know, and until that happens, I will not. Our tribe has taken the position that we will not accept any apologies. And I've been told many times, and sometimes very recently, just within the last couple weeks, just get over it. Or we need to get over this. We need to just move forward. You know, but then I'm going to talk about the whole thing is healing. For our people to heal, we need the truth. How can you heal without the truth? And so the whole, you know, but not only do our tribal members and the indigenous people need to heal, perpetrators need to heal. You can't murder 23 million indigenous people in Mexico and believe that your morality and your righteousness and that the Creator is giving you blessings, continues to give you blessings after doing that to other people. You cannot believe that, you know. And so the perpetrators need to heal. And our belief is that we as indigenous people will not heal until perpetrators heal. So we've reached out to a number of people. I reached out to the state of California. I reached out to the Catholic Church, asking them to work with us to heal each other so that we can both become well together and regain our refine our balance within our own lives and learn how to work forward or going on the path forward and stuff like that. I've yet to have any response of any type on the request to get together. But that whole issue of the apology and the healing are very important for indigenous people.
Elias, what about you? After writing this book, you've been involved in writing op-eds and speaking out about potential legislation. What changes would you like to see?
I think one of the biggest hurdles that Indians have to overcome is first what the missions did to them. One of the things that the missions did was they destroyed various Indian tribes that existed in California. They would take the Indians in to the missions, and as Val said, they couldn't speak their language. Their elders would be the first ones killed off, because the friars knew that they had the oral tradition, and if they killed those off by overworking them, which they did, then the Indians would not have anyone to pass on the oral tradition. A lot of them survived and did. At night, they would gather the children and talk to them and tell them what their tradition was. But when it came, when Mexico freed or turned the missions into parish churches and freed the Indians, they didn't know where to go, because they were the survivors of these death camps. But they couldn't speak their language. Some of them couldn't speak their language. They didn't know where they came from. They didn't know where to go, because all of their lands had been taken by settlers. And then when the Americans came in, that was even further increased. And so they became, in effect, nomads. They were chased. Wherever they settled, they were chased out or killed. And as Val said, their children were enslaved. But the BIA has Bureau of Indian Affairs, where I try to speak my mind about what needed to be done. And I started to say much of what I was saying now, and I was stopped suddenly, and the microphone was grabbed out of my hand. That was a BIA official. And what I learned later was that the BIA is really governed by other Indians. And they realized that they're Comanche, Sioux, the bigger, powerful, more Indian, not more Indian, but the tribes that had survived, they had not undergone what the California Indians had. Their cultures were somewhat intact. One of the things I criticized was, how can you take 25 years to recognize an Indian tribe in an age of computers? 25 years. And that doesn't mean they recognize them. That's how long it can also take for them to say, no, we reject your brief, your petition, and then you've got to start over again. And that's very discouraging. You wait for 25 years and hope that they will recognize, and they don't. And the reason is because they have a set budget, I learned. And the BIA officials don't want to share it, because if they recognize more Indian tribes, that means their budget goes down per tribe. So they'd rather keep it small and be able to give out more money to a lot of tribes.
And that's one of the things that needs to be corrected right now. And then as far as the recognition of what happened in the past, the State Board of Education must say what happened and have and require that not fourth graders be taught how wonderful the missions were, how wonderful Sarah was, but how brutal they were, and not fourth graders, but ninth graders. If the truth gets out to fourth graders, they're going to have nightmares, for Christ's sake. They won't be able to sleep. But ninth graders are more mature, and they can absorb the truth, the reality, the brutal truth of what happened in California, which is very, in some ways, very similar to what the Nazis did in Europe, in their death camps, Auschwitz, Buchenwald. Bring the Indians there, say, all right, when you die, then you'll go to heaven and you'll be free, but you have to stay here for the rest of your lives. But not only those that they brought in, but their children's children were enslaved also. If you were 10 years old, you were considered an adult under the Franciscan friars. And when Peru, the French admiral I talked, in his expedition were several doctors who examined the children, and they found that virtually every 10-year-old had a hernia. How do 10-year-olds get hernia, and how uniform is it among all of them? Well, because they were being used as slaves, and they were carrying very heavy loads. That's one of the things that comes out in Peru's report. So a lot of things have to be done, but basically what Val said is you have to have a recognition, a confession. We killed these people, and as Mariano Payeras said, we have done this. We have killed all of the Indians outside of the missions. They die within 2 years. All we have done is baptize them, administer the sacraments, and bury them. Says they die within 2 years, and this is how it's been. And we did as we were told. The missions are not wonderful places. We didn't say it, but they implied. They were death camps. You went there, and you died under brutal conditions.
You were lucky if you survived, basically. So luckily, there's a lot of new research out there. And I think there's something happening right now with Black Lives Matter and people talking about the truth of the past and let's come to terms with it. Something's happening, and I hope that it just continues.
This has been a special KALW program for Indigenous Peoples Day. In this hour, you heard Lizbeth Haas, author of Saints and Citizens, Indigenous Histories of Colonial Missions and Mexican California. Elias Castillo, author of A Cross of Thorns, The Enslavement of California's Indians by the Spanish Missions. And Valentin Lopez, chair of the Ama Mutsin tribe. Thanks to Chris Carlson, Lisa Ruth Elliott, and the Shaping SF Public Talk Series, which produced and hosted this conversation. This program and a decade of Shaping SF Public Talks are archived at shapingsf.org. And thanks to Dan Gunning for recording this program for broadcast. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening.